Your argument, United States versus Tolliver, Mr. Abel. Okay, may it please the court, judges. I'm here to argue on behalf of Mr. Dunklin. Mr. Dunklin was my client when we went to trial in this matter. The issue that we have regards the admission of tape-recorded controlled buys from an individual by the name of, conducted by an individual by the name of Charles Shy. And what we're saying is that this was testimonial in nature, Your Honors.
Well, not Dunklin.
Pardon?
You can't complain about your client, right?
Oh, no. What I'm complaining about
what
is...
what he said. Complaining about what Shy said, presumably.
That's correct. And the reason why we complain about what Shy said is the person that testified in this case with regard to the transaction was the law enforcement officer who supervised the alleged controlled buy, or alleged controlled buys in this case. The accuser is not the officer here. The accuser is the alleged purchaser of the drugs. And what we believe is that under Crawford versus Washington, the way that the Supreme Court decided it, that this particular statement or these particular statements that were elicited during the controlled buys would be subject to the strictures of Crawford because it is the purchaser, the alleged purchaser, Mr. Shy, who's heard on the audio tape.
Has any court extended the protections of Crawford as far as you're asking us to extend them?
As far as I am aware, there is no court that has done that, Judge
so
Ripple.
You are asking us to break new ground here.
Yes, I believe so. I believe so. And the reason is just that with the Roberts decision, which Crawford sort of overturned, what they said was an unavailable witness's out-of-court testimony was admissible if it was trustworthy. In Roberts, the court goes through this long historical analysis and goes, well, I'm not so sure that this is enough to overcome the confrontation clauses strictures. You know, that in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to confront the witnesses against him. Well, clearly in this case, Mr. Shy was the witness.
Now you're arguing that the government can never use tape, never introduce tape-recorded conversations of a defendant without calling the person, the other person on the tape?
I would believe that that would be true of the tape recorded conversation. Remember here,
well,
I believe...
That would be revolutionary, wouldn't it?
Yes, but I believe that in a sense Crawford was revolutionary in that it did call out these indicia of trustworthiness in these matters and say, well, I'm not so sure that these indicia of trustworthiness
but,
can...
But why isn't it sufficient for the court to instruct the jury that they're only to consider the evidence in what Dunklin said and not what Shy said? Wouldn't that take care of your problem?
Well, I don't believe that it would take care of the problem either, given what the court said about the Roberts decision, that the court was not really sure that there was any way around it. That, in fact, I think that you were entitled to confront your accuser regardless. And clearly, as I say, in this case, the accuser was Shy. I believe
what
that
would you like to ask Shy?
There would have been several things regarding his biases and his prejudices against
Mr. Dunklin. How would that affect
Dunklin?
What Dunklin said in the conversation?
It may not have affected anything that Mr. Dunklin had to say, but it may affect what Mr. Shy's credibility would be in the eyes of the jury.
Why is Shy's credibility important?
Because I believe he is the only witness who actually put crack cocaine in my client's hands, Your Honor. There were other witnesses, obviously, but these witnesses did not actually put the crack cocaine in my client's hands. And Mr. Shy did. So that would be my that would be the reason why I believe he is the accuser. And that
was there an instruction about Shy, about what the jury could do with Shy's share of the conversation?
No, Your Honor. I believe this was more an afterthought with regard to the objection after I'd discussed it with various colleagues of mine. And I believe that the argument does at least hold water with regard to presenting it for an oral argument.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Abel. Mr. Goggin?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to first welcome our visiting judge and just advise him that I always consider this a real honor to appear before this court. I have tremendous respect for the court, even though I don't always agree with him. I have raised the issue of the nature of the jury instructions as being confusing on two points, basically simple reading of them, and then two, creates a situation where there's not unanimity in the findings of the jury with respect to drugs. But what's different about this argument than a lot of the cases that have evaluated jury instructions is my argument is not really that the jury instructions themselves present a problem, but as they reference something that is not a jury instruction, i.e. the indictment, the minute it does that, it creates a real problem, because the indictment in this case reads that the defendants conspired to traffic 50 grams more cocaine. And when we get to charging the jury later in the instructions, we refer to that. And we say, your first duty is to determine whether or not the conspiracy existed as alleged in the indictment. And that's where the jury starts. So they go to the indictment. They're looking for a conspiracy involving 50 grams or more. And if they come to that conclusion, then the 50 grams is presumed at that point. The rest of the jury's duty seems rather confusing. That now, then they're asked to go back and determine if it was less than 5, between 5 and 50, or more than 50. And
well, if it weren't in the indictment, then you'd say, well, it wasn't charged, and therefore, you know, you can't, the jury couldn't find it. You first of all have to have the charge. Isn't that one of the arguments that we've been making in the past?
Unfortunately, that is true, Your Honor, and I don't claim to have the answer to this mix. But
it's not really a dilemma. It said that it's to determine if there is a conspiracy. And yes, that charge happens to be 50. It's not 5 kilograms or anything else. That's what it said. And then it goes through methodically how to determine whether or not it was more than 50 or more than 5, and so the jury's methodically walked through it, so it's not going to be very confusing based on the instructions, at least doesn't seem to me.
Well, let me put it this way. Suppose we were talking about civil liability, common law negligence, and for some reason the duty of the jury was set out to determine whether or not the defendant caused damages to the plaintiff to the tune of $1 million. That's step one in their procedure, and then for some reason, we go back and ask the jury, after they've already made that decision, to determine what the actual dollar amount of damages was. I think the reference to the indictment is clearly asking them to determine if that brief set of facts happened, which includes the 50 grams or more of cocaine. They decided at that point that there has been a conspiracy to the tune of more than 50 grams of crack cocaine.
So what? How would you change the instruction? You shouldn't refer,
Your Honor,
to
the
indictment?
I've thought about this a lot. I don't have the answer to it.
Well, that's not very satisfactory, right?
Well, it all started from Apprendi. Prior to Apprendi, we didn't put drug amounts in the indictment. And then defense attorneys argued they want them in there. And now that they're in there, it's been done in such a butcher way, I don't... The way our instructions are, it's confusing to say the least. Just simply reading it. If you had the other situation where the jury returned a verdict, and I had this happen once, between 5 and 50 grams, when another defendant had more than 50 grams, I guess the argument could be made, well, they already determined a conspiracy didn't happen at the first stage of determining whether or not the conspiracy and the indictment happened to the tune of 50 grams, and then some reason they went back and decided the conspiracy did occur, but between 5 and 50. I think the Supreme Court in its decisions, Apprendi and Post, have created a situation where our jury instructions really provide just a pure slant in favor of the government for
you
conviction.
You seem to say that if there's a charge, then the jury has nothing to do. It's along with the charge, and then, no, that isn't correct.
Well, no, that I agree with that, Your Honor, but their first determination of whether or not the conspiracy existed is not in a vacuum as to whether or not there was an amount involved, because the indictment that we refer them to says it is a conspiracy involving more than 50 grams. So at the point they determined there was a conspiracy, they've already concluded there's been 50 grams.
You think that they're absolutely interlocked? You can't have one without the other.
It's very difficult. The second part of my argument about unanimity is you'd have a situation where, different jurors believe there was culpability for different amounts of drugs. So you could have six jurors believing it was this package delivered that creates the conspiracy, and you have another six jurors believing it was a different quantity or type of drug that created the conspiracy.
Well, I guess too, you're saying, if say there are three packages hypothetically with 30 grams each, mm-hmm. and one half the jury takes these two and the other half takes these two, neither total 50.
Correct.
Are they different? That if you separate them out, the same group doesn't come up with the same 50.
Correct. Anymore.
Thank you, Mr. Goggin. Mr. Norwood?
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court and our distinguished guest. My name is George Norwood. I represent the United States in this case. With respect to the issue raised regarding the Crawford issue, it's very clear there was not any hearsay involved in this case. With respect to Dunklin's statements, and it's an admission by party opponent, with respect to Shai's statement, those statements were only, they're admissible only to put Dunklin's statements in the context. Your Honor's asked about a limiting instruction. First of all, the defendants never requested a limiting instruction. Second, this objection, the Crawford objection, was raised after the close of all evidence and immediately before a closing argument. So it was not a situation where the judge could have given a limiting instruction at the time the tape was issued or entered into evidence and played to the jury. And even before closing arguments, they still never requested a limiting instruction to advise the jury how to interpret Shai's statements. Mr. Abel has indicated that nobody other than Shai put crack cocaine in Mr. Dunklin's hands. The government introduced a number of witnesses, and they're listed in the brief, who all testified about the defendant, Dunklin, either going to St. Louis to get crack cocaine and bringing it back and selling it on the streets of Des Moines, Illinois, or that they bought crack cocaine from this defendant in Des Moines, Illinois. So there were plenty of individuals other than Mr. Shai who attributed substantial quantities of crack cocaine to defendant Dunklin. With respect to the second argument raised this morning, Your Honors are correct. Apprendi does require the government now to put the quantities in the indictment in order to have sort of a notice requirement to defendants. This is the possible maximum sentence that you are facing. I think the jury instructions in this case inured, if anything, to the defendant's benefits in two ways.
Well, I don't understand, because if you look at the what the instruction says, if you find a defendant guilty of the conspiracy charged in the superseding indictment, then you must complete the special verdict form pertaining to the quantity of drugs. But as Mr. Goggin was saying the superseding indictment contains the, it's a conspiracy to, you know, distribute or possess with intent to distribute 50 or more grams. So if they find the defendant guilty of the conspiracy, haven't they found that the quantity?
I think it could be argued that they found the quantity as a whole, but not with respect to each individual defendant. I know that's not required under Seventh Circuit law, but in this case, the Judge Gilbert went one step further and instructed each of the jurors with respect to the special verdict form, you need to find each of these individuals, you need to find a specific quantity for each defendant. But if anything, let's assume the jury thought, well, there were only 45 grams of crack cocaine in this conspiracy. Under the defendant's argument, they would have acquitted the defendant,
no, I understand,
even though a conspiracy
existed. But his argument is it's just confusing because they'd be scratching their heads. Why do they have to complete the special verdict form when they just found that the defendant was guilty of the conspiracy charge in the superseding indictment? That would mean the 50 grams. Right, wouldn't it be better if they said, if the instruction said, if you find a defendant guilty of conspiracy, then you must complete the special verdict?
And it may be that the jury instruction, the jury instruction could have been more artfully drafted. Is this
a pattern instruction or is this ad hoc?
It's the court's instruction. In conspiracy cases, although the government submits a pattern instruction, the court has its own instruction that it uses.
So this is the judge's
instruction that he issues in all conspiracy cases involving illegal narcotics. And I think Your Honor is probably correct that the instruction could read, if a jury first finds the conspiracy involved any measurable amount or negligible amount of narcotics, then a conspiracy existed,
right,
and then go to the special verdict. In hindsight, could it have been drafted a little bit differently? Probably, but was there any type of plain error that affected these defendants' substantial rights? I would say no. Again, if anything, it inured to their benefit in the sense that if the jury found that there were only 45 grams of crack cocaine involved in this conspiracy, their response would have been then, well, the conspiracy wasn't proven, we're going to acquit these defendants, and that did not happen. And because they found on the special verdict form for each defendant, broken down very specifically, that they were each responsible themselves, or it was foreseeable to each of them that there was more than 50 grams of crack cocaine involved in this case, that the defendants were afforded all the rights that they should have under the Constitution, and they received a fair trial. If there are any no further questions.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So do either of the defense counsel have something further you'd like to say? Mr. Goggin?
Your Honor, on this issue of Crawford, I was the one that actually raised the objection at trial at the end of the tape, and although it's not my defendant, it just struck me funny that what the person telling the story on the tape was doing was telling basically a video story, not just a conversation on a telephone, that there would be no question whether or not he said, yes, I was at 6:30 to 10 o'clock. What Shai was telling was this very elaborate story of a transaction that went down. Some of it is probably not subject to Crawford, but the rest of it, the extent of it would be, I would think.
But what if the government had just played what Dunklin said? Would that have been intelligible to the jury?
Probably not. But how difficult would it have been to get Shy there is the whole contention we had. I mean, the government's got the burden. There was no explanation where Shy was. He might have put that on the record. But anyway, clearly, if it was a problem of getting Shy there to clear things up, it should have been done. I think, even though this isn't my issue, wasn't my defendant, I think a reading of Crawford would tend to resolve this issue more in favor of the defendant than the government. That's all.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel. And you were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of the client. And thank you, Mr. Norwood.